Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and this week we're tackling race and prejudice in the United States. This summer, attempts to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, Virginia, sparked protests by far-right activists that ultimately turned deadly, shocking the national conscience. But while many Americans were shocked, for a lot of minorities, Charlottesville was just one more in a long litany of experiences that prove just how far the United States has to go to excise the prejudice that traces back to its founding. So how do we confront this reality? How do we dismantle the hate that has persisted in various forms for centuries? It's certainly a bigger question than a single podcast episode can address, but with the help of this week's roundtable, hopefully we can at least make some progress. First up is Dr. Robert Livingston, a Kennedy School faculty member whose research has included experiments in the psychology of implicit bias, as well as broader examinations of discrimination in society. Next is Professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who joined HKS last year after serving as the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, a division of the New York Public Library and the world's leading library and archive of global black history. Lastly, we have Karen Finney, a fall 2017 fellow at the Institute of Politics here at the Kennedy School. She previously served as senior advisor for communications and political outreach for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Now, few can claim as unique a perspective on Charlottesville as Karen Finney. The child of mixed-race parents, one a black civil rights lawyer, the other a direct descendant of Robert E. Lee.
My parents actually met in New York City and were married about 3 months before the Loving v. Virginia case was decided in 1967, which was, for those who don't know, the Supreme Court decision that actually allowed interracial marriage. After my father passed away, he passed away last year, I found a set of letters that my grandmother, my mother's mother, so she is also Mildred Lee, had written to my father. One set was written before my parents were married, and it was 4 pages, single space typed, laying out various arguments why my father shouldn't marry my mother and should leave her. It ranged from the shame that it would cause not only my mother but the whole family, that it would be a stain, that would be, you know, irreparable damage. She used biblical arguments. She tried to appeal to him because he was actually just graduated from Columbia Law School at the time, so she tried to make a legal argument. Obviously, my parents, they were married about a month later. And then the second set of letters was my grandmother wrote about a week before I was born, and similarly wanted my father to leave my mother. There was even, I know, some members of my mother's family tried to convince her to leave me with my father and move home to Greensboro, North Carolina, and pretend nothing had ever happened. And I write about that because, you know, what I also talk about in the piece is that by the time I was a little girl, that wasn't the grandmother that I knew. She'd actually, I won't say that she'd completely changed. She still, you know, she grew up with the mythology around Robert E. Lee, General Lee, the late unpleasantness as they referred to the Civil War. And she tried to, you know, talk to me and tell these stories. So I grew up hearing that on her side, which I obviously knew wasn't true based on my own personal experience and the experiences of my father's family that also had lived in the Jim Crow South. So I wrote about the statues from a personal perspective to say, you know, my family has gone through a lot to find healing. You know, when my father died last year, whereas my mother's family didn't come to my parents' wedding, some of them came to my dad's funeral last year. And we've had a couple of other sort of family moments where people have been able to put everything aside and come together. So my point was, you know, family history is complicated, American history is complicated, but we have to have an honest conversation about what's really going on here, and we can move on. And I think part of having an honest conversation is, you know, this started, you know, not long after President Obama was elected. The FBI, I think within a month, said that the rise in hate groups, they were already seeing an increase. And I think a lot of people in our country haven't been woke, if you will, to the reality that this has been going on for 9-10 years in terms of really the rise of these groups. I mean, you know, part of the reason I wrote my story was to say racism is alive and well in America. It never went anywhere. But I think we also have to acknowledge that part of why, you know, these statues weren't even built in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. They were built as part of a narrative to honor white supremacy and to really try to remind blacks that, you know, they were not in charge. I mean, it's one of the most, I say, effective PR campaigns in the history of our country. And I say that as a communications specialist. So I think, you know, the key thing is we have to be honest about what those statues really represent. And some of the young people that we saw in Charlottesville at that protest were saying, you know, I'm here to protect what Robert E. Lee represents. And no, you shouldn't be. And, you know, the second thing is Robert E. Lee was fighting on the wrong side. It was not a righteous cause. So he is not to be honored.
After Charlottesville, a lot of people worried about what was happening in our country, that this was okay, that this was socially acceptable for people to go out with their tiki torches and actually express these views in public. But there's also a different level of the issue here, I guess. And it seems to be more along the lines of implicit bias. Dr. Robert Livingston, you have been studying this, and I'm curious for your thoughts on the matter.
Well, I think that implicit bias might have been a more relevant conversation to have about the underlying mechanisms driving some of these issues prior to, you know, maybe 9 or 10 years ago. I think, ironically and tragically, the prejudice is taking a step backwards and we're regressing to more explicit or conscious or deliberate levels of biases, which is what we witnessed in the Charlottesville situation. What's interesting, though, and I think what distinguishes the manifestation that we saw this year compared to a similar sort of rally that might have occurred 60 years ago, is the notion that it's not about racism. And so many of the young white men and older white men that were interviewed said, you know, this isn't about hatred. We aren't racist. This isn't about prejudice against whites. It's more about pride of being, or prejudice against blacks. It's more about pride of being white, which in their minds diffuses, I guess, the malice of the event, in that they're not really against anyone. They're for preserving what they perceive to be white culture. And I think we could sort of debunk that myth of white culture on many different levels. First of all, there's no such thing as white culture. Many of the people striving to uphold white culture come from a culture that bears no resemblance to sort of the white culture of Essex, Massachusetts, right? If you're from, you know, Williamsburg, West Virginia, it doesn't map onto it in terms of preferences, in terms of ideology, in terms of class, in terms of a number of different characteristics. Secondly, you know, the whole concept of white is sort of a social construction, where it is a social construction and it only makes sense in opposition to blackness. So in the United States, prior to emancipation, there were many tribes, if you will, of whites that lived together in perfect conflict. It wasn't harmony. There was no such thing as a white person. There was a Polish person. There was an Italian person. There was an Irish person. There was a Jewish person. There was a German person, right? And they all had their different customs, different traditions, different languages. And they only really became white when blacks started to move, I think, to northern cities. And this is true for World War II and World War I. And there have been many sort of wars among Europeans or white people. So I think people have to realize that this is something that whenever there's voiced support for whiteness, the implicit part of that is vis-a-vis blackness, that being us is not them. So it's a category that's defined in opposition, which actually makes it racist at its core.
Although, can I just add, I do think it's important. Some of the protesters were chanting about Jewish people as well. And part of what I think was frightening is I think you've got You know, I think there's a spectrum on the right. I think there are people, and there have been a lot of studies, I'm sure you all know about them better than I, post-election that showed that fear of diversity, meaning change, the reality, was a higher indicator of someone voting for Trump than economic concerns. And actually, when they kind of, in one study that I read, when they went back and talked to people, what they said was when they talked about fear that their kids wouldn't do better than them, they weren't talking about an increase in the minimum wage, which was a lot of what, you know, the messaging, our messaging was about. They were, and Donald Trump spoke to this very clearly, it was affirmative action. It was, well, women, my kid has to compete with women and black people and, you know, other ethnic groups and those immigrants coming to take our jobs and this sort of race baiting and othering. I mean, Trump has really taken it, I won't say to a new level, but he has made it acceptable. And I think he, you know, he did that throughout his campaign. I think it is, and obviously I take this personally, having worked on the campaign, it is one of the elements that I think was completely under-examined, that it wasn't until for a lot of people they saw what was happening in Charlottesville that people said, what, Nazis? The alt-right? When it's been going on for a long time and it's been right there in front of us. I mean, you can, you know, we haven't touched on it yet, but that is also connected to the conversation we've been having about criminal justice reform. It is connected to, and there are a lot of connections and touch points that we've been talking about over the last several years that I don't think anyone's really kind of pulled all together to say, this is what we're talking about. And I think the last piece I'll just touch on is, you know, let's also realize that by putting Jeff Sessions in as the Attorney General of the United States, talk about having the fox guard the hen house, and Steve Bannon, although he's now left the White House, but putting him steps from the Oval Office, and this is something I said at the campaign managers conference here post-election, I mean, that sent a very clear signal to the alt-right, to the white nationalists, to the Nazi movement in this country, to the Richard Spencers of the world, you are welcome in this White House. And I think that's something we all have to talk about and think about and be frightened about, both as, you know, whether you are black or white, young or old, I think is a very frightening moment for this country.
Well, one thing I wanted to add to this is the political and cultural elite call them the coastal voters of the country, particularly in upper income brackets, have long dismissed the low-grade fever of neo-Nazism and white supremacy in this country as a radical fringe element. And only when that radical fringe element poses an existential threat to federal property, to the president, or somehow burst into the national conversation by some heinous instance of racial terror, do they gain enough of the political and cultural elite's attention. When I moved to Indiana about 11 years ago now to take a job at Indiana University, my driveway was leafleted by a local Klan chapter, not because they were doing a kind of ecumenical outreach to a new black family in the neighborhood, but because presumptively it was a white space, because the Bloomington's about 90% white in terms of its demographics. What they were organizing against locally was Mexican immigration. And it was the target and focus of that local Klan's activity in terms of how it saw the demographic threat of a white Christian nation, which has always been at the heart of how the Klan sees itself. Taking this back into my department with my new overwhelmingly white liberal colleagues was kind of dismissed as just like, oh, well, you know, they don't go to this called Martinsville, a local town where actually a black woman was killed by a lynch mob in 1968 for peddling encyclopedias door to door. So there is this sort of huge disconnect between sort of the imagined racism of the larger Red County place of Indiana, of which there was this horrible history, and in the present, this kind of dismissive reaction to, you know, sort of the presence of but insignificance of the alt-right. And I will say that when Donald Trump, first of all, he's been incredibly consistent for a long period of time, long before he became presidential candidate. But when he staked a claim to birtherism as the most essential element of a rejection of Obama's capacity and rightfulness to lead the United States of America, I mean, clearly this was never about the actual proof of it. It was about cementing in the minds of the alt-right, white nationalists, and others, this very notion that no black person can have a legitimate claim to the office. And that was present in the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan in terms of its anti-Mexican animus, present in the organizing that the Southern Poverty Law Center has been tracking for decades now, since the 1970s. And elites do bear some responsibility for dismissing these things, and I would argue in part because they were no real threat to them until now. And that shift that we saw take place on an elite university campus, the more explicit call for an anti-Semitic politics, Jews will not replace us, brought home in crystal clear terms the new normal of today.
Mm-hmm. Let me build on what Dr. Muhammad just said in terms of how it relates to social psychology, because I think that this does get us back to the topic of implicit bias in a number of ways. Implicit bias thrives under conditions of ambiguity. And what that means is when you don't actually know why the person wasn't hired, or you can't actually definitively point to why this person did X or Y, the research clearly indicates that that's precisely when implicit biases come out to affect decisions and behaviors. And I think one of the problems that we're seeing in the United States, and that I think gave rise to the presidency of Donald Trump, is not the fringe that we're seeing in Charlottesville, or these 10% of Trump supporters that belong or have memberships in neo-Nazi or white nationalist organizations. There is a large amount of both apathy and lack of awareness in this country, exemplified in the example that Khalil just gave, right, of what racism is, first of all, because I think for many whites, even liberal, well-educated, well-intentioned whites, racism is something that's very objective and clear-cut. It's lynching someone, and it's, you know, calling someone the N-word. And anything short of that gets explained away often as you don't quite understand, or maybe the person didn't mean this, or maybe the person didn't mean that. And that often is exactly when racism thrives. There's a lot of research that's shown that the sort of apathy to racism and the self-interest that underlies the apathy to racism, because the system that the neo-Nazis are fighting to uphold is a system that benefits all whites, even those who vocally and consciously disavow the low-grade sort of manner in which this hierarchical arrangement is achieved. It's still beneficial. And so I think what we need is a level of outrage that's similar to the level of outrage. And we saw some of this, that many of the counter-protesters were, in fact, white. But on a national level, on a broader level, in suburbia, in Idaho, in places that, you know, have been bastions of, you know, Trump support, we need to have, I think, more empathy and engagement with how these issues affect us as a nation. The second thing is, it's really interesting that sort of work that's shown that support for candidates like Obama can actually increase implicit bias by providing what are called, by Daniel Efron and others who've studied this, moral credentials. What that means is demonstrating that you're not prejudiced or racist by doing something that on the surface seems anti-prejudice then frees you up in the future to reject a black candidate or to do some behavior that you wouldn't otherwise, because you could say, I've given at the office. I've already, you know, sort of shown my non-racial, report card, and I got an A+. And so therefore I can you know, engage in some of these behaviors that in many ways are in my self-interest. So I don't want to make this sound insidious so that people walk around saying, how can I act in my self-interest while hiding it and seeming like I'm a, you know, good moral egalitarian person. But I think that, you know, there isn't enough awareness in today's world about how ordinary behaviors that are outside of what we see on the television or outside of the Charlottesville or even outside of a lot of the blatant rhetoric of Trump nevertheless serves the same purpose of upholding this sort of racial hegemony within the United States that, you know, pits blacks and Latinos and Muslims and other groups at a really severe disadvantage vis-a-vis whites.
After Charlottesville, there was a reasonable debate about how do you respond? Do you ignore these people and let it go away? Or do you be vocal and try and fight back against it? I think the people who went to, say, Boston Common, they chose the latter. I'm curious about your thoughts on how to approach these things.
I mean, I would say one of the things that I thought was so positive in the aftermath of Charlottesville was so many people from across the political spectrum, across the country, across racial lines, age, spoke out, initially spoke out and then spoke out again after President Trump tried to, you know, have this false equivalency and said, no, 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 white nationalist, no, that's not okay. Now, that is a bright, I think to what we're saying here, that is a bright line that if we can't agree on that, right? I think that was one.
No Nazis.
But I think it creates a moment and it's disappointing that you know, we keep sort of having these moments where we come up to the sort of, you know, the wave kind of crests and then it goes away where we don't have the conversation, because I think that's an entry point to have a conversation about some of the things we're talking about that are other examples of racism and bias, and it is all connected. And I think, you know, it's obviously having grown up as a mixed race person, I think my parents, when they got married in 1967, thought, oh, mixing of the races is going to solve all this, you know, to which I am always like, oh, God, really? You're so naive. But there is something around that. And I'll just, you know, my father was a civil rights lawyer for 30 years. And, you know, his belief was, we can legislate, we can, you know, we have to do all of it, right? That we can change laws and we can change policy, but we also have to have, you know, change hearts and minds. And that, and I personally believe that part of the way we do that is on the individual level. It's when you know someone. I mean, I have a friend who is white, who has a colleague who's also a friend who's black. He's very dark. She never even knew about, you know, racism. It just wasn't in her consciousness until one night they tried to get a cab going to dinner. And for years after, she would go out and get it. They both would work late on the same television show and she would have to go get him a cab. I'm not saying that it has to be that blatant of an experience for everyone, but I do think that a lot of the way real change has happened in this country is not just through policy and legislation. That's absolutely important, but it is also creating the conditions for which we are going to school side by side. We are working side by side. We are having conversations like this, and you have the opportunity to sort of break down those barriers on an interpersonal level. I just don't want that to get undervalued in this conversation, because I do think it's really important. And we tend to talk about big solutions. And I do, you know, marching is important, absolutely. But again, I think there's a lot we can do in our own lives that really matters.
I think to get back to your original question, you know, when you're a kid, your parents tell you, oh, if so-and-so's bothering you, just ignore him and you know, he'll go away. And I don't think that's true in this particular case. If we ignore these alt-right groups, that they're going to go away. And I don't think this is something that needs to be swept under the rug. And I think it's the big white elephant in the room anyway. So I disagree with commentators and, you know, political experts that say, you know, let's not give any airtime to these people, because I think it's already in the conversation. It's been since Obama was elected, and it certainly is more at the forefront now that Trump is the president. You know, economists and social psychologists have written extensively about the signaling power of certain actions and how norms can be created either in favor or against certain types of behavior by showing that they're acceptable or unacceptable. So case in point, I think Trump has merely emboldened these individuals because there have been many signals to say what you're doing is okay and I will look the other way. And so people engage in the behaviors more, maybe the attitudes or the thoughts or the emotions were there before, but now the real actions. And I think that's the power of social norms, is that they can either create or discourage certain actions from occurring. And so I think what's needed is a countermeasure to show that no, contrary to what you may believe, these actions are not okay. And similar to the Boston rally, there are 10 times as many of us who say it's not okay, lest you fall into, you know, the false illusion of thinking that, yeah, there are many more of you than us. That's not the case. And so I think that people need to be very visible and very vocal in confronting these sorts of attitudes that we're seeing now as a means of creating a different set of norms that we know are effective regulators of how people behave, and in some downstream cases, how they actually think.
So I'm going to try to be a little bit more deferential to the activists right now who have been doing the work even before this 2016 election or the recent events that we've been talking about. So if you listen to the young people who animated first the Occupy movement to some degree and most recently in the Black Lives Matter movement, they've been calling our attention to the intertwined nature of racism and economic inequality as twin pillars of structural disadvantage in this country. And as we know, the Occupy movement itself was a consequence of the kind of creeping economic insecurity of middle-class white students whose futures were beginning to converge in ways that produced the same kind of social anxiety that African-Americans and Mexican-American children in this country have been experiencing for generations. That moment produced a very robust vision of a transformed country that I think we ought to pay closer attention to. There are a number of fronts, for example, in the criminal justice arena that aren't just about tinkering with mandatory minimum sentencing. We're really talking about decriminalization, a range of offenses that would fundamentally transform what we do today and what Peter Edelman calls in a recent book, the criminalization of poverty in this country. So I don't want to suggest, that's just one example, that we haven't we don't have resources and we haven't been having a conversation for those interested in transforming this country that provides us with a vision of transformation. As one other aspect of this I think is worth saying is that people like Alicia Garza, who's credited with two other black women for creating the original hashtag Black Lives Matter and has later transformed into a broader movement of which she, of course, was already organizing domestic workers in California. She talks a lot about anti-blackness at the core of a cancer at the heart of America. And what she means by that, by way of simple example, that anti-blackness is not just about social norms around shoot first, ask questions later when it comes to how police officers too often engage black men and women in this country, or black children for that matter. It is also about economic insecurity for West Virginian, white West Virginians or Kentuckians who fight against minimum wage legislation increases or the extension of SNAP benefits or even health care because they imagine that those things make them closer to black people in this country. And so the very intersection of an ethos of anti-blackness that justifies illegitimate state violence and justifies people who are nominally the beneficiaries of government redistributive policies, but who disproportionately argue against those policies because that's what black people get. So it's essentially the twin pillars of racism and economic marginalization are front and center in millennials' activism today. And we ought to pay attention to what they're telling us because they're giving us an opportunity to help to harness and build on the work that they've already begun.
You know, and to bring that back to Charlottesville for just a moment, what's so powerful about what the professor just said and I touched on this a little bit in my piece, I mean, part of fighting the system of white supremacy that was part of, you know, the Robert E. Lee statues were emblematic of. And it's worth noting, I think USA Today, you know, during the early 19th century, we're talking about 31 states have Confederate monuments. I think there are about 1,000 of them. As far as Helena, Montana, which Montana had nothing to do with the Civil War.
Right.
So just to, but to put a finer point on how pervasive this lie was.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it, and this is part of what I think, you know, Dr. King was trying to get to and we kind of have never gotten back to just as a national conversation. That system was also a system that told poor whites, right, that put them in the position of saying, you know, you're going to – it was an economic argument because at that point it was the one percenter saying to poor white people, you're going to be poor, but you're better than the black people, right? And that legacy is also part of what these millennials are touching on in terms of the systemic, historical, how ingrained that is in what we were – the lie that we were essentially taught.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the idea of – when you lose privilege, you actually, it feels like oppression.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real strong psychological basis of that. It's called relative deprivation, right? And so the whole concept of relative deprivation, because if you think about it, everyone in this room and most of the people at this university are really wealthy by world terms, which means essentially you can eat what you want to eat when you want to eat it, which the vast majority of people in the world can't do. And yet we don't walk around feeling like we're uber wealthy because our benchmark of comparison is not a villager in Uganda, it's the Joneses or the people who live next door who have a slightly bigger house or a slightly bigger car. And this also explains why, you know, major league athletes can go on strike because, you know, $5 million a year doesn't seem like a lot of money if you're comparing it to LeBron James or Alex Rodriguez or someone who, you know, who makes $100 million.
Or the owners of the team.
Or the owners of the team, right? So it keeps going. And so, you know, this is part of the notion that, you know, nothing really makes sense in a vacuum when it comes to the human social world, not even something that's seemingly objective like height. So, you know, someone who's tall in Portugal might feel very short if they went to the Netherlands. And so it just it keeps going. And so I think, and I talk about this a lot in my classes and my consulting, because there is the perception that blacks and women have taken over the corporate boardrooms. And when I ask people to tell me out of 500 CEOs, how many are African American, I get some pretty shocking answers. People say 80 or 150. I've gotten as high as 200. And the real answer is 5. And there really haven't been many more than 5 at any one time. It doesn't exceed 1%. And for women, it's never exceeded 5%, which means that white males still occupy 95% of all captain of industry positions, of all chief executive officer positions in the Fortune 500. And it doesn't look very different from that in the public sector either. But the perception is something that's very different. And people think, well, you know, we're used to having 100% and now we only have 95 and that's not fair, right? You're taking over. So I think people need to be very careful about, A, making sure that their inferences square with reality, and B, making too strong of conclusions based on feelings that could be the direct result of relative deprivation rather than any absolute sort of deprivation, because it gives a very skewed vision of reality.
Professor Muhammad, you wrote earlier this year about the basically when President Obama left office, he gave a goodbye speech, and you wrote that the assimilation part of racial integration is essentially over. And just speaking to your point about the level of representation in the boardroom, I wonder how can we bridge that divide?
Well, what I was calling attention to was that for a long period of time, the notion of assimilation as the perfect strategy for winning the hearts and minds of white Americans led to a number of black firsts, from political office to corporate and foundation boards, including any number of appointed positions in the highest reaches of government, and essentially said that with Barack Obama stepping down, we'd see now that no exceptional individual can transform a nation. And said explicitly, not even Dr. King could, for obvious reasons. So that what we needed to turn our attention to was how institutions are always far more powerful than individuals. And as such, individuals need to be judged for the content of their character, not for the individuals who run them. And in thinking about this notion of relative deprivation, in this sense, our institutions have failed us on so many levels. They failed us in terms of diversity as representation and not as substance. I mean, if you take, for example, the content of Dr. King's critique post-1965, just as one example, his critique was that the economics of the nation made it possible now for African Americans to have a seat at the table, but with empty pockets, it didn't amount to much. And in that sense, the time of inequality when he was still alive, measured, for example, by the average CEO's pay to the average line worker in a manufacturing context, was, say, 30 to 1. I think the most recent is approaching 300 to 1, which is to say that the economic question has mushroomed exponentially in terms of the disadvantage inscribed in these institutions, whether they're in finance or even in higher education or even in the public sector, which is being increasingly co-opted by market forces. So as a consequence of that, it is incredibly difficult for working class black, brown, white, and Asian populations, particularly in California, to see themselves doing better in an economy that does not reward hard work evenly. I think it's also important to say that that economic deprivation, that relative deprivation, is no excuse for the alt-right or white supremacy, because if you simply measured the economics of those who voted for Trump, the largest support of white support came from people making between $50,000 a year and $99,000 a year, which is far in excess of the average black worker or Mexican worker in this country paying taxes and going to the polls. So we do have to account for both this sense of loss, which has manifested itself in racism, and at the same time, the legitimate grievance of all workers to some degree in this country who have lost in an economy that does not distribute hard work or reward it evenly, not even by a long shot. Never did, but has gotten worse.
Well, I would love to continue this conversation for another hour, but I know you all have busy schedules, and I want to thank you all so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm Matt Cadwallader. That's at Matt Cad on Twitter. My co-producers are Natalie Montaner, Sarah Abrams, and Becky Wickel. Have something to tell us about this or any other episode? Let us know on Twitter at PolicyCast or via email at policycast@hks.harvard.edu. And visit us at hkspolicycast.org. See you next week.